regards this theme, we started looking at Old Testament history. Pick out one lesson each first Sunday morning of the month that deals with some segment of Old Testament history or another. And sort of the way I grew up and one of the congregations in which I grew up, we were taught to divide the Old Testament into 12 periods of history. Now, you could do that. You could divide it into a number of other periods of history, but 12 is nice because it sort of has that biblical ring a little bit. It's man-made sections. It's all right. You can change it if you want to, but this is what we're going to roll with because there's 12 months in each year. There's 12 sons of Jacob. There's 12 landowning tribes of Israel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the number 12 is a nice number, right? It fits. So we have divided Old Testament history into 12 sections, and each month, the first Sunday morning that I've got up to preach in each month, we've sort of dealt with one section of Old Testament history or another. We're taking them in order. So do you guys remember what the seventh one is? Not quite. That's okay. My mom's, because she was there when we were there, and she taught Bible class at that congregation, so she's like, she's saying what it is. But if you guys remember last month, the last 2 months, I've sort of given a list. I apologize for not giving a list earlier. The last 2 months, I've given a list of each section, and I said today, I'm going to ask everybody to recite it with me. We're going to keep doing this every month until the end of the year. So the first section is pre-flood. Everybody, pre-flood. Okay. The second section is post-flood. Okay. And then number three is patriarchal, right? That's from Adam, or not Adam, that's from Abraham to Joseph. And then we have bondage, then wandering, and then conquest, right? So that's the first six. And conquest is what we talked about last month. So this morning we're going to be talking about the time period of the judges. And so next month we'll be dealing with the United Kingdom, Saul, David, and Solomon. And then the time period after that is the... Come on. There we go. All right, divided kingdom. There we go. I'll forgive you for the lack of unison there. The overhead didn't quite catch up with the rest of us. The divided kingdom, which of course covers the split between Jeroboam and Rehoboam, the southern kingdom, or the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, all the way up to the last king of Israel when Assyria wiped out the northern kingdom in 722 BC. And then we got to the period of Judah alone. Judah alone of the descendants of Israel remains in the Holy Land. Now after that is the period of captivity, right? The 70 years in which the people of Judah, the balance of the people of Judah, were in captivity in Babylon, under first the Babylonian Empire, and then later the Medo-Persian Empire. And then last, we have the period of restoration, right? The period under Ezra and Nehemiah, where the Israelites go back to their homeland, the people of Judah resettle in Judah, it becomes Judea, a province of the Persian Empire. They rebuild Jerusalem, they rebuild the temple. And the young men rejoiced, and the old men wept. So those are our 12 periods of Old Testament history that we're using for our study this year. So this morning, we're dealing with a lesson from the time period of the judges. So naturally, everybody turn in your Bibles to Ruth. There's my little hook there. Now, the time period of the judges was about 350 years. It lasted about that. It lasted from the end of Joshua's war of conquest to when Saul was crowned king. That's the time period of the book of Judges. So what we have during this time period is we have Israel basically repeating its mistakes over and over again. Last month, we actually sort of straddled the time period between Joshua and the time period between Judges. Because I felt that lesson was really important to drive across. When we talked about why do children leave the Lord, why do generations fall away, guess what? It's because we have failed them as parents. That the generation who lived under Joshua and the generation who lived after them did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, but they didn't teach their children properly, and then en masse, they seem to have rejected the word of the Lord. And I understand, like I said last month, there are always exceptions. But when you find an entire generation walking away, it's generally a problem with the parenting, generally. And that's what happened. And so because of that, the nation of Israel seems to go through a cycle constantly. And there's one refrain that's repeated a few times in the book of Judges. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. And it's sort of a sarcastic response because the writer of the book of Judges fully understands that who is the king of Israel? God is the king of Israel. Absolutely correct. God is the king of Israel. And so the writer of the book of Judges is actually writing this line as satire. It's sort of a dark comedy line. And so he repeats this throughout the book to drive home that fact. God is the king, but the people didn't acknowledge him as king. And that was the problem. And so they go through this cycle in which they devolve into apostasy and into idolatry, and they begin to seek after other gods. And so God punishes them. He sends an oppressor. Remember when we did this in our Sunday morning Bible class, the whole Judges cycle starts off with obedience, right? And then goes into idolatry. What's after idolatry? Oppression, right? Until they cry out for a deliverer, for a person to send. And that's what the Hebrew word for judge means, a deliverer. Until God sends them a deliverer. And then they go back to obeying for a while until the cycle starts all over again. And it just keeps repeating itself over and over and over and over again. And it's kind of a sad, tragic note on the history of Israel at this point. And so the balance of the people of Israel were constantly going away from God. Going away from God, going away from God. That's a really big problem. But that's not what I'm going to deal with today. I talk about this to set up the background for Ruth and to set up something really important that we're going to get to in just a little bit. What is our purpose in life? What is it? Well, Solomon says in Ecclesiastes chapter 12, it's to serve God, right? Well, what do we accomplish by serving God? Well, we show our love for Him, right? But what else do we accomplish by serving God? These are actually really important questions. These are extremely important questions that we need to ask and understand. We accomplish showing our love for God by serving Him, by doing what He asks of us. What do we accomplish regarding the outside world, non-Christians? What do we accomplish through their eyes by serving God? We do certain things. There's an interesting narrative in the New Testament where the Sadducees, who love to stir up trouble with Jesus, amongst other groups, they're asking Jesus whether or not Jews should pay taxes to Caesar. So he says, bring me that fish. He says, give me a fish. Now look inside that fish's mouth. What do you see there? Lo and behold, they found a denarius, a coin, a day's wage. And he says, well, tell me whose face is on the coin. Caesar's face, right? So give to Caesar the things that are a part of Caesar's realm of influence and authority. And give to God the things that are a part of His realm of influence and authority. And I'm doing this because the coin had an image on it, right? And it was the image of Caesar. It was the image of the ruler that everybody who saw that coin knew which nation that currency belonged to. And they knew who ruled them. There's a word that's used in that text to describe that picture. It's the word character. The coin was stamped with Caesar's character. That's the word. When people look at us, what do they see? Jesus tells us that they ought to see God. Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. You're the salt of the earth. You're the light of the world. When people see the good thing that you do, they glorify your Father who is in heaven. Peter says that we become partakers of the divine nature
in 2 Peter chapter 1, verses 3 and following, when he talks about all the qualities that Christians ought to have, they're God's character qualities. The reason I'm talking about this, and the reason I set up the idolatry of Israel before, is because Ruth is very, very special. It's a very, very interesting book to me. It's short, but it is full of a lot of important lessons. Most of all, we see a Gentile, a pagan, come to know God through the people of Bethlehem. One of the most fascinating things about Ruth is that we know its backdrop, we know its context, we know the history of the people of Israel at the time in which Ruth lived. And it was mostly full of idolatry and rebellion against God and a complete lack of an acknowledgement of who and what he was. And it was full of people who had abandoned and dissolved their covenant relationship with God. And then we have the people of Bethlehem who are different, who used the name of God on their speech constantly, who everybody in the town seems to be. The general rule for Bethlehem is exactly the opposite of the general rule for the rest of the nation. You have a small community of people who are actually keeping the law, who are actually doing what God had told them to do, and we see this constantly throughout the book, and what we see through that is we see a Gentile, a pagan, an outsider, see the character in the face of God through his people. The people of Bethlehem are a model for us because we can show Ruth the character of God. Lessons from the time of the judges. Interesting facts about the book of Ruth. We know it was written sometime after David was king, maybe during his reign, maybe after his reign. We're not certain, but at least at the very earliest, it was written during the reign of King David. It's also very, very short. The name of God has an unusually high density in this book. The name of God appears more words or more times per word in the book than it does in most of the rest of the books of the Old Testament. It also has the highest density, word density, for another interesting word. This book is only 4 chapters long. But the words, the Hebrew words that we translate as redeem, redeemer, or redemption, occur more times in this book than in the rest of the Old Testament combined. Which is also very interesting. Because Ruth saw the character of God through the people of Bethlehem. She saw redemption. When Ruth first starts off in the book, it starts off with a man and his wife and their two sons, who are Israelites. They're from Bethlehem. But there's a famine in the land. And so they leave Bethlehem and they go into the land of Moab. And then there in Moab, you find their two sons have married two women from Moab. And here's where we learn our first lesson. We learn that God is faithful. Now, what does this have to do with the faithfulness of God? It has quite a lot. There are some things that are there in Ruth that I read, but I never stopped to think about, actually, until Lalo and I talked about Ruth. And he told me one of the things that he brings out when he teaches Ruth. And I'm like, you know, I've never stopped to actually think about that before. And that's really good. We learn about God's faithfulness from the very opening chapter of this book. When God made his covenant with Israel, and he selected them to be a special nation, to have a special relationship with him, to know him more intimately than the other nations were allowed to know him at that point, and he gave them a special law, and he held them to a higher standard than he held the rest of the world. He made a few promises along the way. One of those promises was to provide for them, to take care of them, to bless them, to give them the things that they needed, as long as they decided to keep his law. But as soon as they broke his law, what did he promise them? What do the curses of Deuteronomy say? Famine, oppression from the outside, your livestock will die, your children will be stillborn. All of those things. Guess what was happening in Israel when Naomi and her husband and their two sons left? All of those things. Because Israel, by and large, was being unfaithful. We love to talk about God's faithfulness and the fact that He keeps His word when He blesses us. And I absolutely endorse that concept that God promises to bless us and to take care of us. He doesn't promise to make us rich. He promises to take care of us. There's a big difference. But He promises to take care of us if we seek ye first what? His kingdom and all of His righteousness, and then these things will be added unto you. Your heavenly Father knows that you need these things. If He gives them to the birds of the field, then how much more will He give them to you? Jesus said all those things in the Sermon on the Mount. But sometimes we shy away from talking about the faithfulness of God when it comes to His wrath. And we should never be afraid of that. Because you can't have mercy without wrath. That's the other side of the coin. There's a song that we sing, The Lamb of God. It was written actually fairly recently. I love the song. It's a beautiful, beautiful hymn. And the writers of the song licensed it out to a lot of different churches sort of all over the country, all over the English-speaking world. And they licensed it under the common chord that you, with the terms that you can't change the words. And a lot of other churches, a lot of churches in America, particularly evangelicals, among others, change the words. The writers of the song talk about the wrath of God being satisfied on the cross, which is an absolutely important and necessary doctrinal point of the crucifixion of Christ. That has to be a part of that. But they changed the words to eliminate that phrase, and so the writers of the song sued them and said, "You broke your contract with us. You can't do that. Because we don't want you to change the words because the wrath of God is necessary. And we're not going to allow you to change the words to eliminate that from our song." And so kudos to them for sticking up for this important thing. But just think about what happened. Israel broke the covenant. They suffered the due penalty. And then you find this man and his wife and her two children. They leave. And what happens to them once they leave, which they were, by the way, Israel was instructed not to leave Israel. And once they violate that commandment of God, they marry two women among the groups that they were not supposed to intermarry with. And then what happens? Husband dies. Son one dies. Son number two dies. God is faithful. When He punishes us, that's His faithfulness to us. Now here's the other side of the coin. I got that one out of the way first. God is faithful, not just when He punishes us, but also when He blesses us. Because one of the other interesting things that we find about the book of Ruth is that you have Naomi who says, "Call me Mara," which means bitter, because I'm a woman who's filled with bitterness. God promised covenant faithfulness to Israel. And the thing is, He kept keeping it sometimes even after they broke it. And He always allowed them a chance to repair their covenant with Him. And so what happens when Naomi, who now calls herself Mara, decides she's going to go back home because now I have nobody to take care of me here. One of her daughters-in-law, Orpah, says, "Okay, I'm going to go back home too." The other one says, "No, I'm going to go with you. Your God will be my God. Your people will be my people. Where you go, I will go. Because I will not leave you alone to die." So they go back. And here's the other side of God's faithfulness. As soon as they go back to where they're supposed to be, and as soon as they start doing what they're supposed to be doing again, guess what happens? God reaches out to this woman of bitterness and anger and resentment. And through His providence, and through people following the law that He gave them, He reaches out and He touches her and He says, even though you still hate me, I still love you. God starts blessing Naomi and blessing Ruth. And they are provided for. They are taken care of. They are given all of the things that God promised his people if they did what he wanted them to do. Ruth saw that. She goes into a land that she doesn't know, where she has no relatives, where there are funny laws and strange customs. But here in this small community where her mother-in-law is from, where there are people who are actually following the laws of their God, their people are poor, but they're not hungry. How often do you see that? Here there's a way for them to feed themselves. And here we see that once they do what their God asks them to do, their God showers them with blessings. And Ruth saw the faithfulness of God. And I have a suspicion that once she learned a little bit more about what God wanted from the Israelites, she might have seen the faithfulness in the first part too. We see God's faithfulness.
All right. Sorry about that. I sort of fat-fingered that, had too many hands on the pad at once.
Another thing we learn about God from the book of Ruth is that not only is God faithful, God is merciful. You find this woman who is poor, who has absolutely nothing, who has no way of providing for herself. She's a widow. She has no sons. Under the Israelite law, under the law of Moses, she had no land, because the land would have gone all to her male relatives. She would be left with nothing. And Ruth is in the same boat. But they get to this city. They get to Bethlehem, finally. And Naomi tells Ruth, there's a way we can feed ourselves. Here's what the law, here's what God has asked for of us in his law, and these people are actually doing it. So you go, and you go glean on the corners of the field, you pick up the things that the reapers drop when they're reaping the crops. And another interesting thing is when they get back, did anybody notice when they arrive back in Bethlehem? The text tells us in chapter 1, verse 22, they returned right at the beginning of the barley harvest, where the reapers were just starting to reap, at the perfect time to start gathering. When they go back to doing what they're supposed to be doing, God blesses them and he shows his mercy. Naomi's a really interesting character to me. Because we look at her and we talk about her faithfulness and her trust in God. But at the beginning of the book, it's exactly the opposite of what we see. She even tells Ruth, call me bitter because I'm bitter. I'm angry and I'm hurt. And I'm frustrated, and it's not that I don't believe in God, it's that I kind of hate him right now, just a little bit. Because I've lost my husband, I've lost my sons, you've lost your husband. And I'm just going to go back home to die. It's the woman who considers herself worthless that God places value on. And as the narrative of the book of Ruth unfolds, as we read further into chapters 2 and chapter 3, and I don't have a lot of time to read the whole book. We're not going to be able to do that. But I'll be making references and I'll be making allusions, and go home and read it this afternoon for yourself, and you'll see all of these things here in the book. But as we get into chapter 2, into chapter 3, Ruth begins to go out onto this field. And she begins to start picking up the things that she's allowed to pick up. She gathers from the corners of the fields, from the edges. The things that the reapers are dropping as they're going about their task, they were not allowed to pick up what they dropped. They had to leave it behind for people like Ruth and Naomi. So that Ruth goes and she gathers that, and she keeps going to the same field that day after day after day. And her mother-in-law tells her, you keep going to that field. Because I know the guy who owns it. And let's just say there are possibilities. So she keeps going, and she keeps going, and she keeps going. And keep in mind, just ask yourself this question. Put yourselves in the mind of the people of the town of Bethlehem. Here's Naomi. And you probably remember her, especially if you're a long-standing resident. And here's this woman, this Moabite woman. Do you guys remember where the nation of Moab comes from? Genesis chapter 19. After Sodom and Gomorrah are destroyed by the wrath of God, God's faithfulness, for their sins, Lot and his two daughters sort of run away. They escape. They hide out in a cave. And Lot and his daughters think that the world has just entirely been destroyed. They think everybody else on the entire face of the earth is dead. And so they decide, Lot's daughters decide, that it's up to them to repopulate the planet. And so they get their dad drunk. Pregnancies occur. And the older one has a son named Ammon, and the younger one has, if I remember correctly, the older and the younger. And the younger one has a son named Moab. That's their family history. That kind of relationship, which was highly unclean, and the penalty for that kind of relationship under the law of Moses, as prescribed in Leviticus chapter 18, is death. And so here you have not just a Gentile woman, but you have a Moabite woman, a dirty, unwashed, spawn of incest woman. How do the Israelites generally view Gentiles? Barbarians, unwashed heathens, right? The uncircumcised and uncivilized. Not only was she a Gentile, she was a Moabite, which made her even worse. Even worse. In the eyes of most Israelites. But here's the fascinating thing about the people of the town of Bethlehem. How was Ruth treated? Not that way. Because the people of Bethlehem understood the character of God. They reached out to Ruth. The owner of the field set his young servants, his slaves, really, his young servants, his slaves, in his hired hands. He set them to watch over her and protect her and make sure nothing bad happened to her. This is that dirty, unwashed spawn of incest Moabite woman that this man of Israel is reaching out to with compassion. Most of us in society see the downtrodden and look away, or turn a blind eye, or say a lot of other unkind things, but Bethlehem lived the mercy of God. We look at the other and we think, those bad people. I'm not excusing sin. Sin is sin. It's always going to be sinful. It always is what it is. And there's not an excuse. But how do we treat them? God is merciful. And we can be merciful too. Just like the people of Bethlehem. The second thing, the third thing that we see is that God is loving. Now I want you to put yourself in the place of Ruth. You marry a foreigner. And before you can have any children at all, he's dead. He's gone. Your husband has been taken from you. And out of loyalty to your mother-in-law, she's decided to go home, and you decide that I can't let you starve. I can't let you die. I'm going to go with you and do my best to do whatever I can to help you out and to take care of you and to make your life more comfortable, even though you have no idea what's going to happen. And you get to this town expecting to be shunted to the side and expecting to be neglected and expecting to have to scrounge and to beg and to go hungry every day. But that doesn't happen. The people start to look out for you. They start to treat you in a special way. And there's one guy who takes an interest in you. And who decides that not only does he have an interest in you, he wants to marry you. And this is a radical thing because most women, especially if they were young widows, young widows were some of the most marginalized people in the societies of the ancient world. They were some of the most rejected and downtrodden because every man wanted a virgin. Every man wanted a virgin. That's what they wanted. And so here's this woman who's obviously not, because she's been married. That's okay. It was a marriage. But she's obviously not that anymore. And so here she is, in the most vulnerable position that existed in that society, in societies of that day. But there's a man who reaches out and shows her that she's worthy of love. The most rejected and downtrodden person in that village was given love. Love and a marriage. Boaz married her. And we find the narrative surrounding that sequence of events in chapters 3 and 4. We find Boaz reaching out to her and developing this relationship and showing her that he loves her and wants to marry her. And he shows her something. The reason I use this to talk about God's love is you have a woman who lost a marriage and she gains one back. How did God describe his relationship with Israel? Marriage. In the first three chapters of the book of Jeremiah, when he talks about Judah breaking the covenant, he talks about them breaking the covenant of marriage that they had made together. How does John describe the church in the book of Revelation? Chapters 21 and 22. The bride of Christ. That's the image. That's the metaphor that God has used to describe his covenant with his people from the very beginning of him creating a special covenant with a group of people. You were unfaithful to me, though I was your husband and loved you, declares the Lord. That's from the book of Hosea. This relationship is also used to teach wives and husbands how they ought to treat each other in Ephesians chapter 5. Paul uses this very relationship between Christ and the church to teach how husbands and wives should treat each other, and that the husband should treat his wife as Christ treats the church. And when that truly happens, men, our wives see the face of God in our actions. And that's what Ruth saw through the actions of Boaz. The reason I bring these things out here is actually pretty simple. Because if we're going to talk about being God's people at all, we have to. I mean, of all the character qualities of God, these three are extremely important. Extremely, extremely, extremely important. I did a sermon a few weeks ago in which the primary text that we based everything off of was in Micah chapter 6. Turn there if you will. Micah chapter 6. And I based it on verses 1 through 8. Right? What most of us probably remember is verses 6 through 8, and that's okay, because those are the verses that really is important to remember. It's important to remember that all 8 verses are sort of a covenant lawsuit that God brings against Israel, but verses 6 through 8 are sort of the heart where God gives a voice to Israel in verses 6 and 7. What does God want from me? Does he want sacrifices? Does he want sacrifices of quantity? Does he want sacrifices of quality? Does he want the ultimate sacrifice that I can give, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? But in verse 8, we have what God really wants from his people. He has told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but this? To do justice. To love kindness and to walk humbly with your God. Justice, faithfulness. To love kindness. Practice mercy. And to walk humbly with your God. Love him and love his people. And the same thing is echoed when Jesus goes on his rant against the Pharisees in Matthew 23. And he criticizes them for doing all kinds of things. He says, you pay so much attention to so many aspects of the law. You give great, valuable, precious sacrifices to God. You tithe mint and dill and cumin. But what does he say that they did? You neglect the weightier matters of the law. Matthew chapter 23, verse 23. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites! For you tithe mint and dill and cumin, but you have neglected the weightier matters of the law. Justice, mercy, and faithfulness. Are we God's people? Are we? We say we are, right? And this sermon is not a criticism. I'm not coming down. I'm not trying to claim we're not doing this. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying we're not doing it. I'm just saying, if we're going to claim to be God's people, we need to make sure we act like it, don't we? We need to make sure that we do indeed, as Peter said in 2 Peter chapter 1, become partakers of the divine nature, that we, as Paul said in Galatians chapter 5, that we walk by the Spirit, not by the flesh. Or as John said it, walk in the light. We are God's people, and we absolutely must practice faithfulness, mercy, and love. God's people, those who have made a covenant with Him. If you haven't yet made that covenant, pledged your life to His service and to a dedication to these principles, becoming who He wants you to be, to taking His image, His character, and stamping it on your soul, then you need to. And if you want to do it this morning, there's water prepared. We can immerse you. You can die to this world and be born to God. If you'd like to make your pledge this morning, please come forward as we stand and sing. Or if there's any prayer we can offer on your behalf, please let us know what it is.